From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. The American Civil Liberties Union, or the ACLU, found itself square in the national spotlight not long ago as their attorneys fought against an executive order banning people from certain countries from entering the United States. Last night, the executive director of the ACLU in Florida spoke at a gathering on Sanibel Island. Today, we'll talk with him about what topics came up there and what issues facing Southwest Floridians have the organization's attention. Plus, a new play will debut at Fort Myers Theater Conspiracy, and the playwright is none other than Jeff Lindsay, who penned the Dexter books, which spawned the Dexter TV series. But this play is quite different. The Cave finds a Union soldier, a Confederate soldier, and a runaway slave on a chance encounter while trying to escape the Civil War. But first, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. The man who wrote the Dexter series of books will debut a play in Fort Myers at the Theater Conspiracy this weekend. It's set in the Civil War era, and it puts an escaped slave, a blind Confederate soldier, and a Union deserter together in a hidden cavern seeking sheltered freedom and survival. It's called The Cave, and it premieres tomorrow night at the Alliance for the Arts in Fort Myers. We'll talk with author Jeff Lindsay about this new play, his writing, and more a little later in the show. But first, the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Florida was in Southwest Florida last night making a presentation on Sanibel Island. The national ACLU has gotten a lot of attention since its attorneys fought against the president's travel ban. The weekend after that first well-publicized travel ban fight by ACLU attorneys, the national organization saw a windfall in donations of $24 million from just over 350,000 donors. But before that, and after the election of Trump, the ACLU had already gotten a flood of donations. How does that increase in notoriety and financing affect the ACLU of Florida, and what is on the local to-do list? We're talking with Executive Director Howard Simon today to find out. He joins us by phone. Thank you for making the time to talk with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
We are talking with the executive director of the Florida ACLU about issues concerning our state and region. What are your thoughts, and do you have any questions? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So first, Mr. Simon, what was the meeting about on Sanibel last night?
Well, we were invited by ACLU members and supporters and even other organizations with whom we work closely, like the League of Women Voters, to just describe what our program is in Florida and the plans that we have to try to defend human rights from some of the proposals made by the Trump administration. It wasn't really one subject. God, there must have been, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 different topics that were touched on. I must say that also the people, the folks in Sanibel at the mouth of the Caloosahatchee River are also tremendously concerned, with very good reason, about water quality and the maybe even the poisoning of the people of Florida from toxic nutrients that are being released out of Lake Okeechobee by the Army Corps of Engineers. And that is a project we are beginning to look at by trying to uncover information about that. But I have to say that was one of the things that may have been uppermost on the minds of the folks on Sanibel Island.
Yeah, that's kind of more of an environmental concern, but it seems like it's now seeping over into civil liberties kind of a situation, the way that it's impacting the people there on Sanibel. And
well,
throughout the state.
The civil liberties issue that we're concerned about is, and why we are into it now, is simply to try to uncover the records that the state government and maybe even county health departments are sitting on that people need in order to have information to protect their health
and well-being. So for people who might not already be familiar with the ACLU, mm-hmm. can you explain a little bit about the mission of the ACLU to people?
Well, I appreciate that question because there is so much maybe stereotype of the ACLU or so much of a bad rap, but in a few years we will be 100 years old. We are the nation's oldest and largest civil rights and civil liberties organization. We are based in every state. We are on the ground in every state with staff and ACLU staff attorneys, and our mission is pretty simple. although it is occasionally controversial. Our mission is to make sure that the basic values of the country, that the country was founded on, tolerance, diversity, equality, fairness, and so on, are available to everybody regardless of race, religion, gender, and so on. And we are, most importantly, a nonpartisan organization. We have challenged the policies of Republican presidents and Democratic presidents as well. So we are a nonpartisan citizens membership organization that exists to defend the basic values of this country, typically against the policies of federal, state, and local government.
One of the things that comes as a surprise sometimes to people is the defense of the Constitution and freedom of speech, and sometimes that does include speech that people don't like. For example, defending the right of the KKK to say what they're going to say. That sometimes comes into play.
Absolutely. Freedom of speech is not needed for mainstream speech. Somebody Googles all of the cases before the United States Supreme Court that defines how we enjoy freedom of speech in this country, all these cases are usually on behalf of extremist groups from one end of the spectrum to the other, from in the 1950s and 60s, the freedom of speech and association and assembly on the part of people who were members of the Communist Party, but also as members of the Klan and the American Nazi Party and so on, or people who engaged in really sometimes pretty offensive speech in opposition to the war in Vietnam. So, yes, freedom of speech cases typically involve speech at the extremes of the political spectrum.
And you may not like it, but it still is legal. Can you walk me through the process of working with the ACLU? So if someone has a grievance or they feel like they are being wronged in a civil liberties kind of way, how do they handle that? Do they contact your organization, or does the ACLU go out and look for situations in which they can be of assistance?
Well, the answer is both. With people can go to our website. I mean, it's the historic way in which ACLU has developed its cases in many different ways. But people have contacted us by mail. The easiest way is for people to go on the website, and if I can say it, just ACLUFL.org, and you'll see ways in which if they have a problem. Now, we don't have the resources to take every case, and our mission is pretty much limited to constitutional rights and civil liberties. We're not a general, we're not your local legal aid. So we have a relatively narrow mission. But people have contacted us, and that's the way we've had many cases. A lot of cases that we take because we indicate our opposition to state legislation, and people have contacted us. I mean, you may recall that most recently there was the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit in Atlanta finally struck down the law that prohibited doctors from talking to their patients about the safe storage of guns in the home. We had lobbied against that free speech restriction in the legislature, made our opposition known, and when it was passed and signed into law by Governor Scott, medical organizations and children's health and welfare organizations contacted us, and we intervened in the lawsuits and filed briefs in the courts. So there are all sorts of different ways. I mean, if people saw the movie, there's a wonderful movie that was in the theaters up till recently, I think, called Loving. Loving is about one of the major ACLU cases in our history, in which we struck down the ban on interracial marriages that maybe about a dozen or 18 states had until it was struck down in the late 1960s. The couple involved in that case, the Lovings, wrote a letter to the Attorney General of the United States, then Bobby Kennedy, and asked for help. And Bobby Kennedy said, I can't help you from the Attorney General's Office for the United States Department of Justice, but let me suggest that you contact the ACLU. So Bobby Kennedy sent the Lovings to the ACLU, and we took their case, and a year or two later, the law was struck down by the United States Supreme Court. So there are lots of different ways in which people come to us.
Yeah, and well,
or we seek out cases.
Well, and speaking of marriage laws, the ACLU in Florida fairly recently worked a lot with the LGBT community as far as passing that. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes, we filed a lawsuit on behalf of numerous couples, and I have to say, though, I'm sure you've spoken with her, the leading plaintiff in that case, Arlene Goldberg from Fort Myers, was in a situation in which actually she contacted us because she saw the publicity about us filing a lawsuit, told us her story, that where she had been with her partner for well over 40 years and had been married in New York State when New York State recognized the legality of same-sex marriages, but those marriages were not recognized as legal here in the state of Florida, and she joined our lawsuit, and you probably know the story. The judge, the federal judge, was so impressed by her case that I think he was really moved by the facts involved in her case. In any event, we struck down the Florida ban on same-sex marriages in, I think it must have been January of 2015, that 6 months before the United States Supreme Court struck down the ban nationwide in yet another ACLU case that came out of the state of Ohio.
Mm-hmm. We are talking with the executive director of the Florida ACLU, Howard Simon, about issues concerning Southwest Florida. You can become part of this conversation as well by calling 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Mr. Simon, one of the issues that's gotten a lot of attention in Collier County lately is the agreement that the Sheriff's Department here has with ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Just last week, there was a protest asking the sheriff to end the contract, which has been in place since 2007. It's known as the 287G. Now, Collier is one of only two communities in the state with such a contract. Where does the ACLU stand on those kinds of contracts?
Well, I put it in a bigger context. I mean, this is part of an alternative to immigration reform, which our new president has championed, which is a mass deportation program, and a 287G contract or an ICE detainer, are really part and parcel of a mass deportation program. And I think there are lots of different reasons to be concerned about that. In terms of a mass deportation program, nobody has a right to be in this country without authorization. I understand that. But a mass deportation program that picks up people who may have been in this country for many years with no criminal record, whose spouse may be an American citizen, they now have children. You know, people need to focus on the practical consequences of all of this, and that is the breaking up of families. Previous administrations focused on deporting people who engaged in criminal activity. That's a program that makes sense. Breaking up families and leaving children born in this country here and deporting their non-citizen parents is a program, I think, that doesn't make sense. There's also another problem, and I think eventually, police departments around the country have engaged in what you just described here, and they've been sued. And eventually, I think the Collier County Sheriff is probably going to be sued by a program that holds people in jail without a warrant. That's what an ICE detainer means, and part of what the 287G program involves. There are people who may have been picked up for driving without a license or drug driving or a small misdemeanor offense in which they spend a few weeks in jail and then they're ready to be released, but then they notify federal immigration authorities, and federal immigration authorities, on a request, not an order from a court, not a warrant, make a request to local law enforcement, and law enforcement detains them in jail without a warrant. When communities have done that around the country, they have been sued, and I think it's only a matter of time before Collier County is sued for essentially jailing people without a warrant. We don't do that in this country. We're not supposed to do that in this country. You can jail people, but you got to get court authorization. You don't do it just on the say-so of some police officer
or a federal organization. We asked the sheriff's department if they wanted to be on the show today to talk about this, but they were unable to. Mm-hmm. However, we did get to do a phone interview with them earlier this morning and kind of asked how the 287G process works in Collier County. And here is the chief of corrections, Chris Roberts, what he had to say about it.
Everyone that comes to our jail is asked, where were you born? You know, it's part of identification information that we collect on everyone. If their answer to that is not in the United States, then we ask them, are you here legally? Do you have immigration status? From there, we will verify that status in ICE databases, our deputies will. And if they're not legally present in the country, we will place the initial detainer, which goes to ICE for approval. Nothing happens with the ICE process until they complete their local charges. And ultimately, once their local charges are done, if ICE requests it, they will roll into ICE custody, where they will go to usually the Chrome Detention Center over in Miami. And then there's a whole nother due process, hearings and so forth through the immigration courts that take place before anything happens to them. It's our duty to try and make an arrest for whatever crime it is, and if they come to jail, they're going to go into the process. The rest is up to ICE.
So what I wanted to ask you, if you have a guy who's gotten pulled over and he gets put into the county jail and then he bonds out, or if he goes ahead and serves whatever days and he's finished with his sentencing, at that point, is it illegal for the sheriff's department to keep that person in jail at the request of ICE?
Yes, I think it is. And judges all over the country have said it is. And judges all over the country have awarded monetary damages or assessed monetary damages against police departments that have held people in jail based simply on a request from ICE. Look, you want to hold somebody in jail, go to court and get a warrant. That's the system in America. It's what most of the counties in Florida do. There are only, maybe now two or three counties in Florida that do something different. And I think they're eventually going to be sued like law enforcement agencies around the rest of the country. And so there were two things from this little interview that you played that bothered me. That was certainly one of them. I mean, he glossed over the fact that, when they get bonded out and they go to ICE. Well, he left out the fact that they could be held in Collier jails for up to about 5 days without any warrant whatsoever, which is a violation of constitutional rights. The second thing that he said that really bothered me is that they are now in the business of becoming federal immigration, an arm of federal immigration, by asking people for their papers, essentially. Were you born in this country? If not, are you legal? What's your status and so on? And I have to tell you that law enforcement agencies all over the country, including organizations like the International Association of Chiefs of Police, have absolutely opposed that process. If word gets out within the immigrant community that local law enforcement are essentially an arm of immigration authorities, and they're going to ask you for your papers, and if you don't have papers, they're going to hold you and for immigration officials, there's going to be a shunning of law enforcement by the immigrant community, a failure to cooperate with law enforcement by the immigrant community, and the failure to report crimes, the refusal to have anything to do with law enforcement out of fear that you're going to be picked up and deported. This is, I think, entirely counterproductive and counter to the advice of professional police organizations all over the country.
So I want to ask you a quick question. If somebody is arrested and then they're held over for ICE and then they are found to be undocumented immigrants, are they also do they also have constitutional rights in the United States?
Everybody in the United States has constitutional rights.
Even non-citizens?
Everybody. I mean, a citizen or non-citizen. The Constitution applies to everybody who's here. Visitors? How about people who are here, you know, on a business contract for 3 months who are citizens of some other country? How about tourists? And so the Constitution applies to everybody in this country.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to change subjects here and talk about the concept of sanctuary cities. It's gotten a lot of traction in a lot of places, Southwest Florida being unlikely to embrace such an idea. But the student government here at FGCU has asked the administration to look into it. Where do sanctuary cities or campuses fall in accordance with the law? And where does ACLU stand on it?
Well, where we stand is wanting to embrace the immigrant community and prevent people who are here with no criminal record from being simply deported, from having federal law enforcement agents go on campus to arrest students in a high school or arrest the students on a college campus or knock on people's doors or do raids at the workplace and start rounding up people who are non-citizens. This is not the country I think that, you know, we want to live in, where there's going to be, frankly, what the president said he would do during the campaign, or what he denies that he's actually doing, but it actually is going on now all over the country, and that is a system of mass deportation, forcing state and local law enforcement, first of all, to become arms of immigration, get them to stop people on the road because they look like they don't belong here, and God knows whatever that might mean. And if they're not legal citizens, then they're held and deported. And as I said earlier, we're not deporting the worst of the worst. We're not deporting criminals. We're breaking up families. And
well,
I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt you, but the
thing at FGCU was kind of prompted by the fear of overturning DACA. And there are students,
yes,
you know, here
yes.
that are at our school that have been
right,
here since
right.
they were three or four and
right. so
facing deportation.
That's the next wave. So far, President Trump has not rescinded President Obama's order extending protection for deferred action for childhood arrivals, which is what DACA means.
Yeah.
So the students at the university there understandably are concerned, well, what happens if he does rescind it? Because actually what President Trump said is that he's wrestling with the issue. Who knows where he'll come down on the issue? And if he does rescind it, then all of the children who are all of the kids, they're not maybe not kids they may be anymore, they may be adults, but who are brought here at two or three with their parents are suddenly all, you know, undocumented citizens and subject to being rounded up and subject to mass deportation. Their concern is understandable should he announce a revocation of the DACA program.
Another thing that's come up a lot here at FGCU is we've had a lot of white supremacist flyers showing up. And I wanted to have you weigh in a little bit on where freedom of speech ends and where a person's rights are being violated. Where is that line drawn?
Well, the line is generally drawn, although I don't think it's an imprecise line, although people have used different words to define it. I think the line is drawn at incitement. In other words, you can say offensive things. That's what freedom of speech is in America, your right to say offensive things. Nobody has a right to be protected from being offended. But freedom of speech is not unlimited. Freedom of speech certainly can be limited if it is essentially directed at a particular person or a particular group of people, if it attempts to incite violence against a particular group of people. And, you know, it's going to depend upon, I haven't seen any of the flyers, and I don't know what
it depends
say.
On the verbiage, right?
So, yes, it depends on whether they say just offensive things about a racial, gender, or ethnic group, or they really almost foment or incite violence against a particular person or anybody on campus who's from that particular group. The second is not protected by the First Amendment, and that could be something that should be investigated and prosecuted by law enforcement.
So, and one last question I wanted to ask you. What rights do campuses have as far as being able to limit the kinds of groups that can organize and start putting out these types of posters? Do campuses have rights to not allow, for example, a white supremacist group?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, you know, of all places in the country, I'm thinking back decades ago on my attendance at college. I mean, of all the places in the country, the one place you really would want to defend and protect as much as possible for being open to debate from all elements of the political spectrum, you would think would be a university campus. I mean, if a university, we've been through this in this country numerous times where universities have said, no, this group is objectionable. All groups can form and meet on campus except this particular group. Unless that group is engaged in illegal activity, by which I meant earlier, inciting or fomenting violence, but I don't think the university has a right to limit the free speech of a group because they're what they stand for or the information they put out offends other people.
Okay, I know you have to...
Kids who go to college need to get used to being in the real world, which part of which means being almost continuously offended by things that they see on television, in the movies, hear on radio, see in the streets. That's part of being in a very diverse society here in America.
I know that you had to get going, so I don't want to keep you too long, but I want to tell you I appreciate your time and talking with us, and I look forward to seeing what comes of looking into the environmental situation that was brought up last night in Sanibel.
Mm-hmm. So, and it was good chatting. I want to say in the course of this conversation, I was reminded of the fact that the very first case I was ever involved in when I came to Florida almost 20 years ago, it involved Lee County and involved the school board, and people may remember when the school board was taken over by religious right-wing elements, and the school board adopted a class in Bible history in which the public schools were essentially advancing a sectarian religious point of view, and we filed a lawsuit, and the federal court struck that down. So 20 years later, we're still fighting some of the same battles.
And that was in 97 is when you got here, so...
Yeah, right.
Well, I want to thank you for your time, Howard Simon,
okay,
the executive director of Florida ACLU. I really appreciate it, and it was fun talking with you.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Coming up, he's written novels like Dexter about a serial killer who only kills the bad guys, but Cape Coral author Jeff Lindsay has also written nearly 24 plays for the stage, and one of them is premiering tomorrow in Fort Myers. We'll talk with the author and playwright about the Civil War-era play, The Cave. That's next on Gulf Coast Live.